Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm delighted to be joined today by an author, essayist, and cartoonist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker magazine, The New York Times, The Nib, and Mad Magazine. She also appears regularly on stage, presenting her own cartoons, and also co-hosting a comedy show, whose name we can't mention on the air, along with Ophira Eisenberg. Her books include Mama Tried, Dispatches from the Seamy Underbelly of Modern Parenting, These Things Ain't Gonna Smoke Themselves, A Love-Hate-Love-Hate-Love Letter to a Very Bad Habit, and That Was Awkward, The Art and Etiquette of the Awkward Hug. Emily Flake, it's great to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So your new book, LitHub, calls That Was Awkward one of the most anticipated books of 2019. It is, well, we've all been there. You encounter various people who you don't have an ongoing relationship with. And do you shake hands? Do you hug? Do you kiss on the cheek like the continental folks?
It turns out that there is so much like sort of hunger to talk about this because we don't have like an overarching like agreed upon etiquette for like social anything really. Because I mean, before we were talking in the studio about death, you know, we don't have an overarching societal way for dealing with that either. So like this is sort of like the mini version of that. But when I would tell people that I was working on this book, they everybody like their eyes got wide and they'd be like, oh my God, I had the worst hug with, well, you know. And so everyone has some story of like a hug gone terribly wrong, because we don't know what to do with our bodies ever. And when you're saying hi to somebody, there's always just like that, like, what are we doing beat that kind of messes everything up.
And you have categories for all of the hugs that you may encounter mm-hmm. with the people in your lives.
Indeed, this is, it's kind of like a taxonomy of awkwardness. And so it's like, there are so many ways to interact with a person and so many ways to screw it up that it really seems like, I mean, the possibilities are endless.
So you're a writer and cartoonist, and mm-hmm. your work has appeared in many places that folks might not expect. And you're all, you know, unlike a lot of artists, you're comfortable on stage. Mm-hmm. You get out there on stage and you perform, you call it stand-up cartooning, a hybrid of cartoons and stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm. I do. And in a lot, because I really would never call myself a comedian. Like I have not gone through the rigorous like stand-up, trial by fire that real stand-ups have to do. But I enjoy it in part because I'm chatty and vain, and in part because I feel like it sort of galvanizes me in a way, that just the adrenaline of being on stage and talking and doing this thing and like the sort of immediacy of the feedback that you get when you're on stage is inspiring to me in a way that like if I was just sort of like in my writing room all the time, my writing room, that sounds like I have some like next to my fainting couch. The large closet where I do my work. It's good to get out of there.
Next
actually,
to the laundry.
Yeah. We don't have laundry in my apartment, you crazy. But yeah, it's good just to pull me out of my own head and space and get in front of people.
Well, and also your stage work sounds really collaborative. Mm-hmm. You like to get together with people. And one of the shows that you do on a fairly regular basis is a parenting themed comedy show with Ophira Eisenberg. Mm-hmm. We'll call it Poop Show or S-Word
sure.
Show.
Yeah.
And there's also a monthly show that you do with Kate Willett mm-hmm. Called Nightmares. You talk to funny people about their nightmares?
I do. And Kate is actually not co-hosting anymore. My co-host now is a comedian named Kat Burdick, who I've known for ages, and she is fantastic. No shade on Kate. Kate is amazing. But yeah, it's I enjoy co-hosting rather than just hosting it myself because I enjoy having like conversations with people on stage and just kind of like riffing off each other. And Nightmares is like an interview show. So we bring people up on stage and we talk to them about their nightmares for, you know, 10 or 12 minutes. And I think having two people in the conversation with the guest is just helpful for, you know, kind of keeping it going. And it's a lot of fun. And then at the end, I give them a drawing that I have done in advance of their nightmare so they can keep it or they can ritually burn it.
That's really sweet. Well, you've had some amazing guests on stage with you. You were at the New Yorker Festival. You had Janelle James, Nagin Farsad, Roz Chast. Some of your other shows, you've had Mimi Pond, Wayne White, Dan Peraro, some of the great cartoonists, Bizarro's Dan Peraro.
Right. No, I've been really lucky with both of these shows in terms of like who we've gotten to either come on stage and, you know, tell their nightmares or complain about their kids. So, yeah, it's great. And Janelle James is one of my favorite like people working right now. She's so funny. Just as a sidebar, and has hilarious things to say about her children.
Well, so you do go deep on some weighty subjects, birth, parenting, death. I mean, is it just, is the intent just to dredge this these materials up and be relatable? Are you, are you trying to lighten the mood? Are you trying to sort of do self-therapy up there on stage?
Pretty much all of it. I have a hard time addressing things directly, like without making jokes about it. So my, you know, the only way that I really have into these like weighty subjects is to, you know, like literally introduce levity into them, you know? So really it's just my preferred method of approaching anything. I also know that when I do like more serious work, like I've done some comics kind of like straight up concerning, you know, heavier subjects that aren't meant to be fun. Not that the subjects aren't meant to be funny, but the work isn't meant to be funny. I feel like I like shoot for drama and I hit maudlin almost immediately. And that's not a great look.
So you kind of like to keep that remove. I mean, you're performing in some ways with your visual art, with your art on the page as well.
For sure. And I mean, it's funny, the drawing is like my least favorite part of any of this. I have a lot of baggage concerning how I draw. So it's much more painful for me, and harder to convince myself to do it than the writing or certainly the performing aspect of it. Which is ironic considering I am still paying off that art degree, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, you started out, I'm just interested, was this your first kind of public project, a weekly strip that was called Lulu 8 Ball? And it ran until just recently, just a couple of years ago. And you said it carried the jokes that are too vulgar for grown-up publications and too racy for Mad.
Pretty much.
And this was back when alt weeklies were strong and we were young. I mean, yeah, alt weeklies, they... the ones that are left, they don't seem to be running comics so much anymore.
No, and I mean, there are very few alt weekly papers left. And I mean, they were such an important part of my life in the 90s as I, you know, and they were so, and I mean, the Baltimore City paper is where Lulu started. And that was such a great paper. I mean, they were really the only ones doing like long form, like wonderfully researched, like great journalism work. And, you know, the fact that they happened to run some like cartoons was kind of icing on the cake. And I was very, very proud to be in there. But that it got bought by the Daily Paper. And then and it was already kind of on its deathbed. It got bought by the Daily Paper and it just withered away to nothing. So which I think is kind of the story of a lot of all weeklies at this point.
And then you made a jump to the New Yorker, and you really had a lot of people who were very encouraging and very nurturing that took you along that path.
Yeah. So basically any schmuck can go to the New Yorker and like and show their stuff. And I was that schmuck. So I started going in 2008. You know, the editor at the time, Bob Mankoff, kept like a regular Tuesday office thing where you could just go up and like show your batch. And he would kind of look through it while you sat there and sweated. And then I did that for the better part of a year, and then I finally sold one and kind of, it, you know, then I sold
it
another
takes,
one,
take
off
takes
from
a,
there.
They kind of want to see who's in it for the marathon. They kind of keep rejecting you for months and months and months.
Absolutely. It's like, you know, the Zen monastery of cartooning. You know, you show up on the steps and they tell you to go away. And if you don't go away, then they respect you. Not a great tactic in most of life. Generally speaking, if you are rejected and told to go away, you should take that advice. But in cartooning, it pays to be persistent. So yeah, I and I was really, I don't know, I feel very lucky to have gotten in there. Knock wood.
And, you know, and strangely enough, your writing has also appeared in the Sunday Funnies, drawn by Hillary Price, who's the creator of the comic strip Rhymes with Orange.
Yeah, yeah. She is a lovely human being. I think I have not ever actually met her in person, but you know, we've talked on email, and yeah, I have written a few jokes for her.
And but you know, by and large, you really like. You really like the gags or the humor that people would call it edgy, but it's really more real. It's about what's going on in social situations. It's what's going on in just being human, interacting in strange and awkward ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would hesitate to describe myself as edgy. I'm just not very well house trained.
And the Nib, which has become the go-to online source for political cartooning, that has become one of your homes nowadays. But your contributions have really veered more towards social satire.
I mean, I think that's part and parcel of like what the Nib is. You know, I mean, it's a very political publication, and I think I skew more towards the sort of social end of that. But it certainly feels like a more of a space to talk about, like, if not politics directly, at least, you know, things that are going on in society, not so much like feelings.
Well, how people are affected by what's going on in the big global political scene.
For sure.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today with Emily Flake. She's a celebrated cartoonist for The New Yorker magazine and the author of Lulu 8-Ball, These Things Ain't Gonna Smoke Themselves, Mama Tried, and That Was Awkward. So you have, one of your books is Mama Tried, Dispatches from the Seamy Underbelly of Modern Parenting. And you have a seven-year-old daughter now. And yeah, nothing like parenting to provoke all sorts of creativity.
Oh, man. I mean,
generativity, as they say.
She really provides me with an endless amount of material. She earns her keep. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I saw where you had recently, your daughter Tug was writing freestyle raps about how fluffy her hamsters are.
Yeah, yeah, she has gotten super into writing raps. And when I say that, I feel like I should issue the caveat of her familiarity with hip hop basically comes from watching America's Got Talent and her obsessive love of the song Old Town Road. She does not have a super deep well of hip hop knowledge, but she really likes it, and she just sits there and just writes raps, and it is very, to me, it is very cute. So, yeah, I put one of those on Twitter a couple days ago, and it garnered a lot more attention than I thought it was going to, which I felt a little bad for, because I felt like I had sort of exposed her in this way that she is unaware of and hopefully will remain unaware of until she's like a teenager and she's going to hate me anyway.
Well, you know, I think this is kind of a running situation with cartoonists is you have kids, they're going to wind up some way in the cartoons, whether they're actually named like Dennis Ketchum and Dennis the Menace, or whether they're, you know, like Lynn Johnston used her kids' middle names and for better or for worse.
And I think that anybody, you know, if you're a writer or a comedian, artist, whatever, you know, you take at heart a mercenary view of your life and the people in it. You know, it's, I mean, is it Nora Ephron who said everything is copy? So it makes you a not good person, basically. But I think there's always that running track in your mind of like, how can I use this? So it's not something I'm proud of.
Well, and also there's just, I mean, family situations. It brings up so much. You wrote a piece for the Nib, and you know, most of your stuff, it's like snarky takes on on body of politics or the world at large. But this one was very personal. It was called It's All in the Family. And it starts out where you're saying, my family has a bright, sour thread of madness running through it. Schizophrenia, psychotic breaks, OCD, depression, anxiety. We celebrate the entire DSM-5.
Right. We do, you know, not to brag. But yeah, no, that's definitely like a part of my family story. And, you know, part of it is that my parents don't read The Nib. I've never showed them this comic. They will probably never see it. And I'm fine with that. And that was kind of one where because I more directly addressed family members and their lives, you know, you could argue that it would have been better of me to ask. I did not ask. But it also felt like something that I needed to say about, you know, my fears concerning mental health, et cetera, et cetera. Also, if they ever do find out, you know, it's better to beg for forgiveness and ask for permission. So,
well, creativity and mental health variations, you know, mm-hmm. this has been a longstanding, there's been a connection that is not exactly a secret.
Right. No, for sure. And I mean, I hate the idea that, like, you know, that mental illness or any kind of madness gives you some sort of like romantic edge as an artist. I mean, in many ways it can really, there's nothing particularly productive about depression. But, you know, like anything, the experiences that you have, like with your brain, give you something to make art about. So I think there's that. And I think if you are, you know, mentally, if there's like a divergence between your worldview and the commonly accepted worldview, it's like it makes a space for you to step into and see things from a different perspective that make you a better artist. I just, my main beef is with the idea that there's like a romanticism to it, or, you know, if you're nuts, it makes you a great, or, you know, like, I don't think it guarantees you any like success artistically.
Well, and that whole sense of second guessing, that's reflected in that piece that you did, It's All in the Family, where you say, can a hollow woman raise a whole unbroken child?
Mm-hmm.
You're worried about, you say, that bright, sour thread.
Right.
I worry that it will take your daughter away to a dark place,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes she cries inconsolably and says heartbreaking things like, I'm stupid, I'm useless, I mm-hmm. want to go home to God.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there's that concern always about inheriting these things. And saying it out loud, you know, in a way, that seems healthier than putting it away in the attic.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, talking about something is just helps you understand it, you know, it gives you, whether or not you make art out of it or write about it, I think just being able to tell a story about it, even if it's just to yourself, I think is very useful in a therapeutic way.
And another sort of way that you've gone against the grain of the popular culture, American culture, is you were part of a show called Death Panels,
right.
Comics That Help Us Face the End of Life. This mm-hmm. was at the New York Public Library. I love that it was called a pop-up graphic medicine exhibit.
Yeah, it was part of a larger festival called Reimagine that was all about like artistic responses and societal responses to death. And the aim of that festival was to basically talk about how we talk about death, which is a very tricky subject. And a lot of the other cartoonists on that panel either had some medical training or were doctors. And it was kind of like, and there was an idea that having sort of a graphic narrative that they could give to patients of like, how do I talk to my parents about end of life, et cetera, you know, just being able to have the conversation, being able to make that conversation easier, I think was a real aim of both that panel and the festival.
Oh, I would love to see an advanced directive drawn by you.
Right, yeah.
You know, with little panels and everything.
Yeah, seriously. I just got to do that up and get it notarized.
Well, one of the comics that I loved, you have every morning, your daughter, Tug, says to you mm-hmm. on her way out the door, I love you. I love you even after I die.
Yeah.
And you said that's a sweet and utterly macabre way to start the day.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like, you know, when you're a parent and like you have so much love for this person that has, like, you know, is the next link in the chain. I feel like the thought of their eventual, like, demise and your eventual demise is never very, like, far from you. But I never thought that, like, my child would sort of have that in her head, too. I mean, she worries a lot about our impermanence. So there's that.
Well, it's interesting to me that you are, you are both a cartoonist of some risque and sometimes difficult material, mm-hmm. and also a Sunday school teacher. So you have mm-hmm. that great balance. I think it's no surprise that a couple of your artistic influences are Edward Gorey and Gayon Wilson.
Right.
Kind of like that gothic sense. Huh?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I am large. I contain multitudes. But yeah, no, it's I have a lot of different ways to address humanity and the divine, I guess.
And, you know, there's nothing ungothic about the Episcopalian Church, for example.
Yeah, no, I mean the vestments and the swag is very, it's got a lot of the Catholic theater, which I really enjoy. We don't do like the incense thing, but you know, we take communion weekly, and the vestments are cool, you guys. If you go to Episcopalian Church, the vestments are cool.
And I love that, you know, you grew up in New England, mm-hmm. so you have this, you know, interesting sort of dark woodsy kind of thing in your blood, really. Mm-hmm. And you call yourself an illustratrix.
Right. Yeah, that's something I started like putting on my, you know, website when I was like 20 years ago. I just thought it would be a cute way to, you know, feminize the word illustrator and, you know, make me stand out a little bit. I don't know. Maybe I just like X's.
But you're also, I mean, your work is in some ways a throwback to mm-hmm. you like physical media. Mm-hmm. You like working in watercolor.
I do.
And this is not the fake watercolor that you see in computer apps. This is mm-hmm. real honest to God watercolor that could make a horrible mess if
right.
you do it wrong.
It's true. And, you know, nothing against digital media. Done well, I think it can look really fantastic. Eleanor Davis just posted a piece she had done for the Times that, like, it was that she had done digitally, and it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And it really has come an incredibly long way. You know, since the early days of Photoshop, I myself have not mastered, you know, the digital tools as yet. But I do appreciate the sort of chaos element of working on paper. And I like it on a physical, I enjoy the sensation of like a pen or a brush dragging across paper more than I do like a stylus against glass.
Yeah. Moving the body kind of gets the mind moving too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you're a knitter as well.
I am. You know, what's funny is I used to knit all the time. And when I was supposed to have 3 weeks left of being pregnant, and I was knitting socks. I was knitting lace socks. And then I went into labor and had my daughter like 3 weeks early, and I never finished that sock, and I never picked it up again, and I have no idea. I don't think I could do it. Like, you know, I could knit you a scarf, but I would really have to get way back into it to like get to lace sock level. But I do love a yarn shop.
How is living in Brooklyn? You've lived in New England. You were in an interesting town called Manchester, Connecticut, mm-hmm. where...
Interesting's an adjective.
Yeah. Did this inspire you growing up around, you know, places with oddball statues and fountains and murals? And
I think so. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think what would characterize my upbringing in Manchester was just sort of like a sense of loneliness and a desire to leave. And I think those are two things that are helpful to the young artist. So... Manchester reminds me a lot of Derry, Maine, if there are Stephen King fans out there. You know, it definitely has that kind of like, you know, quasi-haunted New England sadness about it. And then I left when I was 17 or 18. I went to school in Baltimore. And then I lived in Chicago for 4 years, and I've been in New York for 15. So I got out of that town as soon as I could. But it definitely had some, you know, some aspects about it that I think were probably fairly more formative than I care to admit.
And one of the things you love about New York is that you can engage your desire for collaboration. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people may not know is that you did the illustrations for a book by the editors of The Onion, by several contributors to The Onion. It's mm-hmm. The Devious Book for Cats. It's a parody of the, what is it? The
Dangerous Book for Boys. So they did two. There was The Dangerous Book for Dogs and The Devious Book for Cats. So it was five Onion writers. And they
was anybody credited? Because it's hard to find your name.
Nope.
On it.
No. That book officially is by Rex and Sparky. So take it up with them.
But yeah, you said that the Onion offices were a great place to hang out for all sorts of cartoonists from all over the city.
They really were. So they had this tradition called Whiskey Friday, which is exactly what it sounds like. You could just show up at the offices around 4 and start drinking heavily. And it was really like, you know, we're talking like, you know, circa 2004, 2005, that was, and you know, for years until, well, I stopped going when I got pregnant because, you know, they frown on you, Whiskey Fridaying when you're, pregnant, but it was a really like important kind of social and artistic nexus, for me and for everybody who went, really. So it was, I miss it very much.
So it got the creative community working together, but it also launched these crazy projects that, mm-hmm. You know, people said, well, here, I've got a wild idea, and you're on your, you know, third shot of whiskey, and and then it ends up being a book.
Yeah, yeah, and sometimes it just ends up being a hangover, but, you know, like, often it really led to things.
So the book is, I'm just going to hawk it again. The book is That Was Awkward, The Art and Etiquette of the Awkward Hug, and it's pretty much just out on the shelves right now.
Yeah, yeah, it is a brand spanking new book.
And Joe Biden is not mentioned in it.
He is not, yeah. I was hoping that the book would have a longer shelf life than Joe Biden's gaffes, but he is definitely like an A-plus awkward hugger.
Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite little chapter in there? A favorite awkward hug that you'd like to mention?
One of my favorite ones. Do you want me to read
it? Sure. Yes. Go for it.
So this is actually the first one in the book. So the book is kind of like a taxonomy of awkward hugs. And this first one is recent ex's long-term relationship. So the ink is still drying on the divorce papers. The books and records are mostly split, except for that one shelf of bathroom reading stuff. And honestly, you can just keep it, Carl. You are, for the moment, seeing the same therapist, but on different days, and only until you can find a new one who takes your bull word insurance. This is a hug born of a toxic brew of physical force of habit, a desire to keep things civil for the kids, and a need to do something with your body in the moment other than use it to hit something. If you put spray foam into the space between two bodies engaged in such an embrace, the shape it assumed could be put in a museum entitled Resentments. The saving grace of this hug is its brevity. No time for awkward equivocation here. It is a physical expression of terseness, at once familiar, you do, after all, know this body well, and repelled. This body did butt stuff with the nanny, and you'd just as soon throw it off a cliff. Arms don't go around torsos or necks so much as they form a barrier between the participants while allowing for a brief, vicious clasp squeeze of the shoulders or waist with the hands. A strangled bye, muttered between clenched teeth, is permissible but not required. After all, haven't you talked each other to death at this point? My God, this hug is a bummer.
That was awkward. The art and etiquette of the awkward hug. The author is Emily Flake. Emily, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for those listeners who'd like to find out more about your other books and projects, where can they look?
EmilyFlake.com, EmilyFlake.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. Many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.